Chapter 13. Doctrine and conduct are related to each other as cause and effect. This affirmation may require a little explanation, because so many people think of doctrine as belonging solely to ecclesiastical circles and as being quite unpractical even there. They think of fierce doctrinal disputes that ministered occasion for rancor and bitterness without teaching anything of real value. The fact is that through the weakness and yet the pugnacity of human nature, great and important truths are continually obscured by disputes regarding matters of relative insignificance. Great truths are hidden not only by falsehoods, but also by little truths, just as a great mountain may be hidden from sight by a too near and intent inspection of a tiny piece of stone. Doctrine really means teaching. The word can be used in a much wider sense than is generally recognized. The doctrines that a man holds are really the principles that guide his conduct. If his doctrines are well balanced with a just perception as to which are the most important, his conduct will probably be well balanced too. If he holds some false doctrines, or if his strongest convictions and most persistent thoughts center around something of little value, the ill effect will be seen in his conduct. Beliefs may be of all shades of strength, from a slight inclination of opinion to a confidence indistinguishable from absolute certainty. If a Christian has real faith in his religion, and if he attaches the proper importance to Christian doctrines, he not only has a strong hope in life, but his conduct is guided at every point. As the Apostle expresses it, he believes with his heart unto righteousness. Effects do not follow causes at uniform speed. If the foundations of a building are knocked away, the superstructure will fall in a few seconds. A subterranean tunnel might last for many days or even weeks with inadequate supports. Gradually, the pressure from above would force the roof to give way, and eventually the aperture would close completely, but it might take a long time. In the complex human mind, the effects of changed thought may be still slower in manifesting themselves. Habit may persist, and the old course of conduct be pursued long after the foundation has been destroyed. Still, more time is needed for great changes in human society as a whole. There are so many cross currents and eddies of opinion to retard the general trend, and thus, still more to delay the final effects. The question has sometimes been raised as to what the effect would be throughout Christendom if all faith in the Christian foundations were shattered. Some years ago, a writer attempted to portray such a condition. There was much controversy as to the accuracy of the picture presented. As usual, disputants went to extremes. On the one hand, it was supposed that the triumph of unbelief would immediately result in a complete repudiation of all moral restraints, while, on the other hand, some critics argued that human conduct would be unaffected. The truth, surely, is that very grave effects would follow the death of Christian faith, but they would follow slowly. There is surely no need to argue the matter. We can see the changes that have taken place already, and the gradual effects of those changes. We can hardly believe that any competent observer would deny that this is true regarding Britain during the last 50 years. There is less belief now in the foundation of the Christian religion, and there is a corresponding change in moral conduct. There is less regard for duty, a greater demand for pleasure, not such faithful service, a looser conception of the marriage tie, and in many ways, less honesty. In any attempt to trace cause and effect in these matters, it should be remembered that a clear contrast between a nation of Christians and a nation of atheists is impossible, except by an effort of the imagination. the real disciples of Christ have always been in the minority. It should be remembered, too, that all except very earnest Christians are more influenced by public opinion than by Christian precept. It needs a very brightly burning faith to make the recollection of one of the old commands a more potent influence than the insistent protest of living neighbors. Another important factor of which men often lose sight is that many of Christ's commands are so clearly good for life that now is, that society has every reason for emphasizing them for its own protection. A nation that cast off all the restraints of moral precept and allowed the worst effects to follow might soon be compelled in some measure to retrace its steps by the destructive effects of its own excesses. So we can imagine a completely atheistic nation, if one could exist, settling down eventually to a kind of life in which there would be some indirect recognition of God in a selfish respect for the laws of nature. Men who depreciate the influence of Christianity would perhaps be content with such a condition. If so, it means that their standard is a low one, and that may account for their failure to perceive the full working of this law of cause and effect. It is possible for a great decline in morals to be unperceived if observers are changing their own point of view at the same time. If we desire to trace cause and effect in connection with the matter of Christian ethics, we need to take note of all the facts just mentioned, and at the same time, take care that we do not vitiate our judgment by changing our own standpoint. We have a nation with Christian ideals, Christian hopes, and a Christian code of morals. A few people are fully persuaded as to the foundations of their religion, the conviction being so strong that it is a hearty belief unto righteousness. A few at the opposite extreme have rejected Christianity entirely and would like to destroy the faith of others. In between the extremes, there are men and women of all grades. The man whose faith is not strong enough to keep him from sin, but quite enough to make him miserable with self-reproach. The man who holds to religion with the idea of being on the right side in case there should be anything in it. The man who does not fear God, but fears public opinion. The man who is mainly indifferent, but who has a measure of fear and a measure of love for God and for the devil, for the church and for the world. The man who swings from one extreme to the other, sometimes responding to the call of ideals and sometimes to the call of the flesh. Finally, the man who lives on the animal plane and seems unable to escape from it, even for a little while. Suppose that in the course of 50 years, a change takes place in the attitude of the leaders of thought. What gradual effects might be expected to follow? We should surely expect a gradual change in public opinion, and therefore a double cause of change in the influences brought to bear upon the majority of the people. When such a change takes the easy line of negation, repudiating the authority of teaching hitherto revered, the rank and file will readily follow the leaders. Under this influence, men who in old days would have assumed unreasoningly that the old authorities were true will now, with equal lack of reason, assume that they are false. Gradually, the habits of duty or prohibition, which are entirely based upon the old authority, will be changed, and even the moral laws, which are also emphasized by human necessity, will be weakened. This is the kind of change that we can observe in modern English life. For many years now in England, there has been no coercion to make people go to church. The only reasons men have had for attending a place of worship have been a desire to go, or a conviction that it was a duty charged upon them by Christ and his apostles, or mere obedience to a respectable convention. Of recent years, some religious teachers have joined in the avowed enemy in undermining the authority of the Scriptures, with the very natural result that people do not so much trouble to go to church. At one time, it was quite usual for Christian households in England to have Bible reading and family prayers every evening in their homes. Now it is rare. A perfectly natural result of a change of doctrine, beginning with leaders of thought, gradually changing public opinion, and then affecting the conduct of the people. If Christians believe that Jesus was the anointed of God, and that he uttered the words regarding worship recorded of him in John chapter 4, they will surely desire to render the worship required. If, however, they are assured by those who are supposed to know that the fourth gospel is neither inspired nor authentic, but the imaginative work of a later writer, it is perfectly natural that they should lose interest in the idea of worship altogether. Who knows whether God requires it? The older members of the family take their rest, and the younger members get on with any worldly amusement that attracts them. There are probably many modernists who would claim that these changes are of no importance, or perhaps even that they are beneficial. Such men do not recognize the virtue or the good in anything that fails to yield obvious temporal benefit to the human race. The first part of the old law of love is thus completely ignored. There is no obvious and immediate advantage in loving God and rendering worship to Him. The claims of our neighbors are more insistent, for human life is hardly possible without some effort to recognize human rights and to render social service. Thus, an educated and intelligent selfishness demands that some of the teaching of Christ should be respected. Many people seem to be drifting into this position, and there is a tendency to suppose that it is quite satisfactory. It is still described as Christianity. The relationship between doctrine and conduct is surely very obvious in all this. We should suppose that even the most definite rejecter of the higher claims of Christ would be logical enough to recognize that if those claims prove true at all, the conduct of the men who have repudiated them will not be regarded as satisfactory. When a long-absent king returns with overwhelming power to take possession of his country, he will surely choose for his friends and assistants the men who have waited and labored for him in his absence, not those who have proclaimed that he would never come back, and that none of his commands had any authority. The mere fact that they have respected those of his laws that accorded with their own interests will not commend them much. We can illustrate this law of cause and effect on a lower plane, where its operation may be followed more readily. Even when the immediate interests of society demand that respect should be shown to Christian principles, there is a tremendous difference between the effects of a Christian ideal and the mere dictates of human prejudice. Take two subjects in which the immediate interests of human beings are vitally affected: the sanctity of the marriage tie and honesty in the ordinary transactions of life. From the Christian point of view, these matters are both covered by the two major principles of obedience and love. They are also the subject of many practical exhortations designed to drive home the lessons of the main principles. From the point of view of temporal human interests, both subjects are of such importance that here, if anywhere, we might expect to be able to knock away the foundation of doctrine without any effect on human conduct. If men have good homes, they desire to preserve them, even if they might, in certain circumstances, be willing to wreck the homes of others. Men always hate dishonesty in other men, even if they practice it themselves. Society may, therefore, be expected to set up defenses in these matters, and here the influence of Christian teaching might be regarded as negligible. In point of fact, however, anyone who has had opportunity to make a contrast is conscious that there is a great difference, even here. In the matter of marriage, the majority have always fallen so far below the Christian ideal that there never has been any true Christian society with which to make effective comparison. Nevertheless, it is clear that the decline in faith during the last 50 years has already had its effect, even in this. The general standard of honesty was always deplorably low, judged by Christian ideals, but surely everyone will admit that in this pleasure-loving, Christ-rejecting age, it has fallen lower. On every hand we hear the same complaint, and unless we are exceptionally fortunate, we share in the loss and vexation. If we can make a contrast between the real, wholehearted Christian and the wholehearted rejecter, the effect of doctrine on conduct is unmistakable. To get light on the Christian point of view regarding these two subjects, read the 5th and 6th chapters of the letter to the Ephesians. If you believe that the writer was an apostle, called by God for special service, and that he was commissioned, as he claimed, to enlighten the Gentiles by writing to them the commandments of the Lord, take careful note of these chapters and observe how searching and comprehensive they are. If you do not believe in the divine call of the writer, still take note of the words and judge of the influence they should exercise on one who admits their authority. The principle laid down in chapter 5 has been little heeded, even by believers. Many readers, both men and women, have formed the strange notion that the apostle puts the woman in a position of subjection and demands much from her while requiring little from the man. As a matter of plain fact, the command to husbands is far more searching and drastic than the command to wives. The husband is called upon to love his wife, even as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it. Even so, says the apostle, ought men to love their wives. Christ gave his life for the church while it was full of imperfections. He loved the church so well that he was willing to die in agony for it while it was quite unworthy. If a man makes even an honest endeavor to live up to this ideal, it is very improbable that his wife will be unwilling to fulfill her part of the contract. No rules devised merely by the prudence of man can take the place of this Christian ideal. It is anti-Christian thought that makes unhappy homes, whatever name the faulty ones may bear. Where the Christian rule is remembered and recognized as the law of God, disciples may find their way into a temple of domestic joy, the very existence of which is unknown to others. It is possible, even on this blighted earth, to experience an Edenic happiness, marred by nothing except the dreadful law of death. And to a Christian, even death is not so dreadful as the wreckage of homes so often seen when Christ is rejected. Perhaps it is still easier to perceive the difference made by Christian doctrines in connection with the other subject we have mentioned, honesty. At first sight, some readers might think that here, at least, we have a principle of right conduct so fundamental that Christian ethics would make very little difference. The interests of society, in the philosophical sense of justice, would alike seem to insist that this ideal must be maintained, even though Christ should be rejected. Study the teaching of the Apostle Paul and note the specific instructions showing what is involved in the Christian idea of honesty. The disciple of Christ must be honest in the sight of God and man. He must give the just weight and just balance, and good service, all rendered as unto the Lord and not unto men. As a servant, he must serve well, even though his master is unworthy. The Apostle Paul is not alone in this teaching. Christ emphasized the same fundamental principle, and the Apostle Peter also presents the thought in language equally emphatic. If some should ask rather bitterly, "What of the masters?" we find that the instruction is equally definite. Very severe condemnation is passed on masters who fail to realize their obligations. The essence of Christian doctrine in this matter is that we must give, hoping for nothing again, rendering the honest service as unto the Lord, and not waiting for the other man first to show himself worthy. When a man definitely abandons this ideal and repudiates all Christian authority, he will soon have a very different conception of honesty. There are still millions of men and women who would not deliberately steal either money or goods, even if they were sure of escaping detection. They are not honest, however, with their time and their service. They set up their own idea of justice to themselves and wait for the other party to come into line before being prepared to give of their best. They put the emphasis on receiving instead of on giving, and that is one of the greatest curses of the race. Many thoughtful men realize that the human race is confronted with terrible dangers. There has been a mighty increase of knowledge, though not perhaps of true education. All classes are articulate and grasping for power, while the world becomes increasingly full of human beings. Unselfish, unstinted, and all-round service is needed to save the race, but no merely human conception of honest service will move men to lead the way. There is truly a vital difference between the man who renders a merely human conception of the fair deal, with covetous eyes on his neighbor's goods, and the man who works with singleness of heart on Christian principles, with good will, doing service as unto the Lord, and not unto man. We have yet to see what results may follow the abandonment of the Christian ideal in a world linked together as now, with such widespread knowledge and such potentialities for good or evil. Whatever results follow, we may be sure that doctrine and practice will always be related to each other as cause and effect. Sometimes the effects come quickly. Sometimes they are long delayed, but they inevitably come at last. The conduct of men may often be inferior to their doctrines. Their actions fall below their ideals. We must not ever expect their works to be better than their faith.